Good afternoon. I would like to welcome you today to the Frist Center for the Visual Arts. My name is Julie Roberts, and I work here in public programming. We're pleased that you've joined us today for the last of our off-the-wall lecture series focusing on the Hudson River School exhibition. The series is principally informative and critical with speakers that have challenged us to look beyond our first response of aesthetic wonderment in the work and consider their alternative contributions and impact on our social history. The Frist Center would like to thank David Wood, professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, who has acted as moderator for the series. His thoughtful selection of speakers and topics has definitely heightened the level of interest for many in this exhibition. Please join me today in welcoming Professor David Wood.
Well, thank you so much, Julie. And as you know, this is the last of these three talks on the Hudson River School of Artists, a fabulous exhibition of works from the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art. In the last series of these talks we put on, we heard from photographers and writers and art historians. This time we've branched out even further. We've heard from a practicing artist in the landscape, Chris Drury, and his concerns with the detachment of the artistic gaze. We've heard from my colleague, philosopher John Stewart, who I'm pleased to say is here again in the audience, who championed Martin Johnson Heed's late paintings of marshes as the most authentically American representative of this tradition, the Hudson River tradition. And today we're delighted to welcome Dan Usner, who will give us a historian's take on some of these paintings. Professor Usner is the chair of Vanderbilt's history department and the Holland M. McTeer Professor of History. He received his PhD from Duke, and Vanderbilt recruited him from Cornell about 3 years ago. Dan is the author of a number of books on the American Indians, especially but not exclusively of the lower Mississippi Valley. And he's working on a volume on American Indians in the Gulf Coastal South. He's a native of New Orleans and currently teaching a course devoted to the impact of Katrina on the Gulf Coast. Some of the paintings in this collection are very, very explicitly foreground Native Americans. I'm thinking of Cole's The Last of the Mohicans, Bierstadt's Toward the Setting Sun, and the very early painting by Van der Linde, The Murder of Jane McCrae. Occasionally, you'll find teepees in the background of other paintings. But by and large, Native Americans are missing from these works. Why is that? I believe Dan Usner will help us understand what's happening here from the point of view of a social historian. And I welcome Dan to talk to us today on this topic.
Thank you, David. Thank you, David, and the Frist Center staff for making this event possible and for creating an opportunity for a social and economic historian to use a platform about a school of art about which he knows very little, but hopefully will use as a springboard to dive into some topics that are, hopefully you'll agree in the end, somewhat indirectly related to the works of art that are featured in this exhibit. On November 28th of this year, I would like the lights, since I have no technology, no slides to show you, actually just some pages that you'll want to look at different points in the lecture. The lights will be helpful, much better. On November 28th of this year, the United States Supreme Court made a decision that I'm sure none of you noticed. There's so much more happening in the world and in the nation. You were probably preparing frantically for Thanksgiving. But on that day, the United States Supreme Court decided not to consider an appeal to a decision that a New York State court had made some months before, allowing Iroquois Indian communities in upstate New York to open casinos, especially in the Catskill Mountain region. So this opened the door much wider for American Indians in New York State to expand already existing casino economy in a part of New York State that you see featured in some of the paintings of this exhibit. Now, after 9/11, the opening of Indian casinos became even more attractive to Governor George Pataki and others in New York State as a way of helping revitalize certain regions in New York. And of course, you probably know something about the history of Indian gaming and the spread of casinos across the United States. And now you're probably wondering whether you're at the right event or whether, you know, I understand my assignment. But the issue of Indian casinos, particularly opposition to Indian casinos, is something that might lead us into a fruitful discussion of the images featured in the exhibit. Now, there are many good and bad reasons for citizens of the United States to be opposed to Indian casinos. Donald Trump, for example, has many bad reasons to oppose casinos. But Americans of all kinds object to casinos because it's simply a form of taxing the working class American. It's immoral, perhaps illegal, although the courts are ruling otherwise. But another important current of opposition to Indian casinos is that of all people on the American landscape, why Indians? Doesn't this seem to be inappropriate for American Indians? So I would like to suggest that some of the thinking along those lines could date back, if not originate, in the artwork that you see in the Hudson River School of Art. And what I want to do is situate the visual images in a larger context. First of all, the context, as David alluded to, in which through literature, art, scholarship, and of course government policy in the 19th century, American Indians were being erased from the American landscape. So I want to connect the art to other manifestations of this erasure of American Indians, at least in literary form, if not in physical form. And then, as a social and economic historian, I want to give you a glimpse of how American Indians actually did appear on the landscape of upstate New York in the 19th century. And finally, just gesture towards images, alternative images that we as art historians or just simply people who take pleasure in seeing images from the past ought to consider in juxtaposition with the images that are featured in this exhibit. So I think it's clear, it's self-evident, that the landscape paintings in the Hudson River School, when they did include Indians, and they seldom did, situated them on the margins, literally on the margins of the canvas, as tiny romantic figures, usually in the foreground or on a precipice. And we have some wonderful examples in this exhibit. Thomas Cole's Caterskill Falls, 1826, and John Kensett's Niagara Falls, 1855, are two that I would like you to keep in mind in particular. looking at the relationship between art and literature and the relationship between their treatment of American Indians and American Indian people has no better ground than New York State in the 19th century for the following reasons. First of all, the Hudson River School and its importance in American art history. James Fenimore Cooper, the best-known 19th century novelist who treated American Indians in his work. Thirdly, the origins of American anthropology can be traced to central and upstate New York in the 19th century. And finally, the importance of tourism very early in New York State's history. In all of these media, American Indians were relegated to a liminal, even invisible, position on the landscape, as well as in Americans' vision of their future, as so brilliantly expressed in the art. One could argue that in all of these media, the vanishing Indian was more and more essential as time went on, but essential in a region still inhabited by thousands of American people, mostly the Iroquois. Cooper wrote novels, as you all know, that featured American Indians, but American Indians in the past and or on the verge of extinction. And indeed, one of the Cole paintings in the exhibit is a scene from The Last of the Mohicans. Cooper, however, denied contemporary Indians in New York any substantial presence. All of his Indians were situated in the past or the sole survivor or a remnant of a vanishing race or tribe. Indeed, the Iroquois communities of upstate New York had been destroyed during the American Revolution by Continental armies. And they were dispersed and scattered, many of them moving into what became the nation of Canada, as well as other parts of North America. The destruction of the Iroquois during the American Revolution, of their communities, played into the imagination of many whites who saw the end of this political confederacy. Really, it was an interruption or a setback in the history of that confederacy as a sign of the disappearance of American Indians altogether. But I'm here to urge you to think that a reduced and scattered population, whoever they are, in this case the Iroquois, is not synonymous with their disappearance. And that was certainly the case across upstate New York, where New England, as well as New York and Canadian Indians, traveled widely using the Hudson River Valley and other parts of the state throughout the 19th century, and I would add throughout the 20th century. But art and literature in the 19th century depicted Indians as timeless, unchangeable savages. And this, of course, was becoming more and more instrumental in non-Indians' identity and sense of their nation's future. Just look at Cooper's own life and times. Look at where he grew up in central New York. And it will not take long to find living American Indians who regularly appeared in Otsego, New York, to hunt and fish, to peddle surplus, catch herbs and medicines, and handcrafts like baskets, moccasins, and brooms. A local tradition in that part of New York State even claims that Cooper's Chingachgook, was modeled after a Mohican Indian basket maker and hunter named Captain Jack, who frequented the neighborhood in Cooper's early life. Now, the frequency of these visits by the likes of Captain John indeed diminished over time, even in Cooper's lifetime. But they survived nonetheless. By 1850, Susan Fenimore Cooper, daughter of the novelist, could observe, quote, "Now they come very seldom and singly or in families, craving permission to build a shanty of boughs or boards in order to ply their trade of basket makers." These Indians, of course, paled beside the imaginary characters that were being created in Cooper's writings. And Cooper himself was not very impressed by these Indians, whom he depicted as degraded in relationship to their ancestors. In a journal he wrote, "They are all alike, a stunted, dirty, and degraded race." These are not the Indians, though, who appear in his fiction. This placement of American Indians in art and literature as people relegated to the past, as a vanishing race, or as the paintings highlight, passive observers of their own destruction and disappearance, also observing the advance of progress. This, of course, became a trope, a major image in 19th century art of all kinds. Painters popularized in Currier and Ives prints depicting the march of empire oftentimes had an Indian or two or an Indian family on the edge of the canvas watching the wagon trains, even the railroads, cut across diagonally the painting and the American landscape. And this would extend to the Trans-Mississippi West in the Rocky Mountain School of Painting. This depiction of Indians, this placement of them on the margins, obscured the actual methods and mechanisms of the Indians' displacement. And perhaps we can talk about that, how the art and the literature sort of subverts that and actually conceals it from our view. Now, the art, of course, was creating expectations, not only about the natural landscape and the environment, but about the disappearance, the invisibility of American Indians themselves. And so travelers, of course, found what they expected. In some ways, they were educated, they were informed to look at the landscape without Indians, or imagining Indians somewhere on a precipice or sitting as a lone figure along the lake. Theodore Dwight was instrumental in educating Americans in the early 19th century about how to travel, how traveling and spending time in the natural world was essential for their education, for their civilization. He was the great-grandson of Jonathan Edwards, a nephew of Timothy Dwight, president of Yale College, and he himself became a publisher and writer of travel accounts. In a book published in 1829 entitled Sketches of Scenery and Manners in the United States, he is looking down in one passage on the Connecticut River from Mount Holyoke, and this is what he describes. "The first inhabitants who might have still possessed their country, but for that race who were destined soon to overspread the soil and eradicate every trace of its original occupants, are now gone. We look in vain on the rocks around us for any testimony of their existence. Not an inscription, not a mark, is anywhere to be found. And we may scrutinize with our utmost care the whole region below us without discovering a single monument to their virtues or their misfortunes. a few rude implements or broken weapons of war with a few traditionary tales, as scattered and as rare, are all that now remains of the original possessors of the soil. The people who first knew the beauties of this river and its meadows, and who shed their blood in vain to preserve them. There's not only sort of an erasure of American Indians from the landscape in this kind of writing, as well as in painting, but there's a silencing of them. In this passage and other passages in that same book, and very common in other writings, is the notion that American Indians were so beleaguered, so overwhelmed, that they were even unwilling to speak up on their own behalf. This leads to the issue of anthropology, and I'm not going to say much about the role of anthropology in this. Perhaps this is something we can discuss later. But anthropologists, by the end of the 19th century, certainly saw themselves as fulfilling this role, as it being their responsibility to capture the lost cultures and languages of American Indians, in a sense, to speak on their behalf by doing field work, by visiting American Indian communities and capturing their traditions and their ceremonies before they would ultimately and inevitably vanish. And New York State was a very important scene for the origins of that undertaking that we now call anthropology. Henry Schoolcraft, who actually was assigned as an agent for the United States government to take a census of all of the Iroquois communities in New York State, published a book in 1847, right in the thick of the Hudson River School art, called Notes on the Iroquois. And then Lewis Henry Morgan, an even more important figure, a man who grew up in central New York, became a lawyer, took a deep interest in Iroquois culture, befriended some very important Seneca families, and wrote in 1851 League of the Iroquois, which is considered to be the first modern anthropological study of an American Indian group. So keep that in mind when looking at the art or when reading Cooper or travel accounts, that anthropology is another important literary sphere in which American Indians are being relegated to the past, being marginalized in the American imagination. The noble savage is a convenient phrase that we use to capture much of this. And indeed, whether we're looking at the paintings or reading Lewis Henry Morgan or Theodore Dwight or James Fenimore Cooper, Indians are being turned into exemplars of natural freedom. This is the definition of the noble savage. And in that representation of American Indians, there was absolutely no space for the actual adaptation that American Indians themselves were attempting in dealing with the realities in their own communities and around their communities. And so the presence of Indian people, where they were, in fact, commonly being seen, was consequently denied. The economic life of Indians in states like New York, across the East, where most of the Indian population indeed was removed by the mid-century, is a story still untold because it defied the literary and artistic erasure as well as the physical and political removal of Indian peoples, especially during the Jacksonian era. Henry David Thoreau participated in this process in a very interesting way through his deployment of opposition, and it's opposition that is so central to these paintings. The opposition between nature and economy, between Indian and white, between wilderness and civilization. Now, we know now that Thoreau and his own interaction with Indian people was instrumental in the formulation of his thinking. But paradoxically, Thoreau proved to be intolerant of Indian people's interaction with the nation's economy or with the economy of New York State, although he was obviously influenced even by that interaction. In a journal entry referring to Indian removal, he wrote, "For the Indian, there is no safety but in the plow. If he would not be pushed into the Pacific, he must seize hold of the plow tail and let go of his bow and arrow. A race of hunters can never withstand the inroads of a race of husbandmen." And keep in mind that Thoreau was an opponent of Andrew Jackson's removal policy, a sympathizer of American Indians, and yet even he saw them as really having no chance for survival. There's an interesting passage that you might recall from Walden in the chapter Economy, and it's the tale of an Indian basket maker as told by Thoreau. "Not long since, a strolling Indian went to sell baskets at the house of a well-known lawyer in my neighborhood. 'Do you wish to buy any baskets?' he asked. 'No, we do not want any,' was the reply. 'What?' exclaimed the Indian as he went out the gate. 'Do you mean to starve us?' Having seen his industrious white neighbors so well off, he had said to himself, 'I will go into business. I will weave baskets. It is a thing which I can do,' thinking that when he had made the baskets, he would have done his part, and then it would be the white man's to buy them. He had not discovered that it was necessary for him to make it worth the other's while to buy them, or at least make him think that it was so, or to make something else which it would be worth his while to buy. I, too, had woven a kind of basket of a delicate texture, but I had not made it worth anyone's while to buy them. Yet not the less in my case did I think it worth my while to weave them, and instead of studying how to make it worth men's while to buy my baskets, I studied rather how to avoid the necessity of selling them." Quite simply, Thoreau here is turning a common class conflict, which many American Indians experienced in the 19th century, into a philosophical meditation of his own on economic self-sufficiency and creative integrity. Scholars, thankfully, are finally rescuing American Indians, in this case 19th century Iroquois Indians in upstate New York, from that ideological denial and erasure by examining the actual presence of Indian people in the economy in places like upstate New York over the 19th century. And we are now finding that activities long considered pathetic and impoverished by the likes of Henry David Thoreau to actually be important means of survival, even resistance and identity. Indians, in that regard, were not unlike non-Indian contemporaries, especially in the early 19th century. They were trying to reconcile tradition with transformation, autonomy with accommodation, continuity with adaptation. And we could even read in their behavior, yes, even in the selling of baskets door to door, a counter-narrative to the Hudson River School of Art and related literary materials. Indians were constantly crossing borders, connecting places, even families, non-Indian with Indian, moving between spaces, in defiance of hardening racial lines and ideological boundaries. Yes, this interaction was unequal, increasingly so as time went on, but it was ongoing and changing. Indians appeared all across the landscape of New York in the 19th century in ways that were not pleasant, were not even acceptable to observers like Thoreau or Dwight. They appeared, in addition to living on their reservations, off those reservations as agricultural workers on nearby grain and dairy farms, as day laborers, canal workers, boat crewmen, guides on hunting and camping excursions, fur trade employees, timber cutting and rafting workers, door-to-door peddlers, dance performers at circuses and exhibits and eventually expositions, and producers and sellers of arts and crafts to tourists, and yes, even by the end of the 19th century, as high steel construction workers. When the first railroad bridge was built across the St. Lawrence River in 1886, partly on Iroquois land, the agreement was that Iroquois men would be allowed to work for that construction project, mainly just as carriers of burden and non-skilled workers. But very quickly, they demonstrated their ability to work on the bridges. And this began their tradition of Mohawk men across the United States and Canada becoming some of the most skilled and famous high steel construction workers, building skyscrapers in cities like New York. This is part of a long tradition of economic adaptation and resilience by Indian people across New York. And we wonder why we see none of this in the images and even in the writings. It's because Indians were appearing in all the wrong places, according to 19th century ideology. And this, of course, was particularly problematic for tourists, especially those on what was called the Grand American Tour, which included much of New York, traveling up the Hudson River, on the Erie Canal, stopping at Lake George, eventually heading and reaching Niagara Falls. Real Indians threatened the pilgrimage by their very presence, defiling the sacred landscape and upsetting the pastoral social order. Nathaniel Hawthorne visited Niagara Falls in the early 1830s and wrote a wonderful piece in which he begins by expressing high expectation, then early disappointment, but then he realizes the wonder of what he experiences. But there's an interesting passage that is all too easily overlooked early on in his visit to Niagara Falls. At the toll house, he wrote, there were further excuses for delaying the inevitable moment. My signature was required in a huge ledger containing similar records, innumerable, many of which I read. The skin of a great sturgeon and other fishes, beasts and reptiles, a collection of minerals such as lie in heaps near the falls, some Indian moccasins and other trifles made of deer skin and embroidered with beads, several newspapers from Montreal, New York, and Boston, all attracted me in turn. Out of a number of twisted sticks, the manufacture of a Tuscarora Indian, I selected one of curled maple, curiously convoluted and adorned with the carved images of a snake and a fish. Using this as my pilgrim's staff, I crossed the bridge. And then, of course, he went on to see the falls. This passage from Hawthorne I use now simply as a guide to some alternative images. And you have those alternative images, or a sample of them, in the handout. Where do we begin to look for paintings, sketches, even photographs of American Indian people as they appeared on the landscape? Well, first of all, maps is used. The use of maps is one way. And the first two pages, front and back, are maps from an 1890 census, a special census of New York State Indians. And this will show you where the Indian reservations were located or still located by the end of the 19th century. And the second map is actually a map of the Tuscarora Reservation. Look at the names, the family names. Look at what is depicted on that map, and these communities begin to become or feel real, perhaps for the first time, as a student of the 19th century. So that's why those maps are there. The other images, though, or images of Indian people as they appear on the landscape in those problematic and even troublesome ways to tourists, artists, and writers. The first image is of Tuscarora bead workers selling their wares at Niagara Falls. This is a very early photograph by William Notman, which he sent to the Prince of Wales in 1860. The second image is of a traveling Mohawk family, again selling beadwork. This family is from Ganawage on the St. Lawrence River, just upriver from Montreal. And this is dated around 1900. The third image is by a very well-known German-born painter, Cornelius Krieghoff, who moved to Canada and painted many wonderful images of American Indians. And this one is entitled The Basket Seller, done around 1850. And finally, my favorite one of all, Jacob Riis's Mountain Eagle and Family. You're probably familiar with Jacob Riis and his depiction of urban life, working class life, poverty in northeastern cities. But we wouldn't expect an Iroquois family to be living in Brooklyn in the early 1890s. But indeed, this was a family of the head of that household was a construction worker, high steel construction worker, part of what was a growing Mohawk community, still there, in Brooklyn, New York. And yes, the family is doing beadwork, preparing, making goods, which they will sell to tourists and others. I want to end quite suddenly and simply by asking you, when you look at the Hudson River School of Art, particularly John Kensett's Niagara Falls, done in the 1850s, that you please think about pictures like these as well and consider the presence of American Indians on the 19th century landscape. Thank you.
Thank you. Is this working? Yes. Thank you so much. It's sort of fascinating to be asked to look at what's not in paintings, what's not there, what's missing. But I want to start out with I'm just going to ask a couple of questions, and then we'll open this up to the audience here. Really a kind of more general question about your work as a historian, or what historians do, because, you know, at one level you could say that after all, the victors write history, and it's not just that they have the privilege of writing the history in which they have won, but in a sense they're correct in doing so, because they will have changed the world, and the world will move on from the state that they've created. And that what those who have been defeated or passed by don't make history anymore. They, in a sense, they're part of the process, but they're the excluded. They don't actually make much of a difference to the way the world moves forward. So if you were to hold a view like that, what kind of historian is it that goes around recording the state or the plight of those who have lost in history? I mean, is it really history, or is it a sort of ethical response to the marginalized. And do you see what I'm asking?
Yes. And this will date me and situate me within the history of American history. I mean, my interest in American Indians is really part of a wider interest that I had very early in my career as a historian in capturing or rescuing the voices, the agency of the marginal, of the oppressed, whether they be immigrants, urban working class, small farmers, tenant farmers, sharecroppers, slaves. Inevitably, one reaches American Indians, particularly if you study the 17th and 18th century South, which is what I really do for a living. Now, in my generation of what we called ourselves new social historians, for a very long time we were quite naive about the importance of our saving the voices and agency of Indian people. We simply looked for voices, looked for evidence of their behavior, whether it be surrender, survival, resistance, accommodation, in defiance of the master narrative, of the role that this ideology of conquest played. And only in the last decade or so in my own work have I felt compelled to kind of confront the construction of narrative, the conquest narrative in particular. And this has made me, I hope, a more thoughtful observer of images, literary as well as visual images, because more and more of my work is a combination of social history, writing about what people did, as much as possible what they thought they were doing, along with the kind of deconstruction that I very feebly demonstrated up there, of the images of the narrative itself. So I'm trying to create a conversation between the narrative of conquest and the narratives of resistance and survival. And we are starting to realize that American Indians themselves played interesting and often contradictory roles in the construction of the master narrative. Louis Henry Morgan could never have written League of the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois Confederacy without some Iroquois people being implicated in representing themselves in ways that were consistent with Morgan's expectations, but were also somewhat subversive. In other words, they were using Morgan as they used other writers for their own purposes. So we're starting to realize that there's a conversation, a very important conversation, in the construction of a dominant narrative. And it's not just a narrative up against people being exploited by the narrative, but it's the exploitation and the conquest actually drawing American Indians into the process itself of representing themselves and resisting images of themselves.
You know, if you go around and look at these paintings, I mean, some of them are, you know, stunningly beautiful, you know, with or without Indians. And I'm wondering whether you think of them as social documents. I mean, in a sense, your talk today treats them a bit like that. But do you think that if you do that, do you think that that undermines their aesthetic qualities? I mean, do you think it helps us to know these things or to think about these things? I mean, part of the point of this series of talks is to take a second look at the stuff that we just enjoy. But does that second look, at least in your view, especially given the sorts of considerations you're bringing to bear on these paintings, does it enhance our enjoyment of them, or does it simply add more information on the side that might even detract from our pleasure? What do you think?
I think I'll take the easy route to answer that and simply say that there's a we conveniently create a wall I'll use wall between enjoyment and understanding, although we know, it's permeable, it's porous. I can enjoy these paintings for the beauty represented as well as the aesthetic genius that it takes to produce them on one hand, but also understand the role they played, the misunderstanding, the misrepresentation that went into their creation. So I can have it both ways. I can enjoy them. And my greater understanding of them, which is still a work in progress, does not really undermine or exclude the possibility of my enjoying them.
And I think the last question I'll ask, I've got various other ones up my sleeve here, but you told me that you, when we discussed these things before, that you'd curated an exhibition of perhaps less prominent or publicly available images of Native Americans. I take it as a kind of a counterweight. I mean, you didn't think of it perhaps as a counterweight to this exhibition, but I wondered if you could just say a few words about what went into that and what you thought you were doing.
In fact, what I did in a very sketchy way here is something that I've done more extensively for the South, especially the South that I know best, the Lower Mississippi Valley, the Gulf Coast. Several years ago, I worked with the Historic New Orleans Collection, which is a private research center and museum in New Orleans, to feature some 60 images of American Indians just in the New Orleans area. And this is something that began for me when I was doing research for a very different project. I started to stumble upon images, scattered images. They were not collected or compiled, and I kept track of them, and many of them were actually in the Historic New Orleans collection. But I approached the director of the center with this wild idea of really trying to feature the way these images of Indians over a long span of time, the 19th century, particularly to capture changes as well as the complexity of those images. But I wanted to do more than that as a social historian. I wanted, even though I wanted to kind of critique the images, I wanted the people coming to the exhibit to understand, the bias built into the images. I also knew that the images could reveal something useful about the lives of American Indians in the 19th century. And so I tried to do both by juxtaposing images with writings, and then even involve, and this is very important for this kind of project, to involve Louisiana Indians themselves in the story. And so one of the most rewarding aspects of that exhibit was to involve Indian families bringing their own albums, which included photographs that dated back to the late 19th and early 20th century, and to give them an opportunity to kind of show their own images of themselves. And so it was a wonderful experience that I had, and we brought images from Europe and other parts of the United States that had never been pulled together and displayed in a single room, along with material objects like baskets and wooden implements that were indeed that were dated to the 19th century. And so we had those three-dimensional works of art or arts and crafts in the same room with paintings and illustrations that depicted Indians making and selling those objects. So I've just kind of revealed why I'm so interested in baskets, because certainly basket making is not the only activity one could feature when talking about the presence of American Indians in 19th century New York, but it just happens to be something that I've focused on for some time, not in the Northeast, though, in the South.
I think we should open this discussion to the floor. Yeah, gentleman here.
About 2 weeks ago, we were in the Smithsonian's new Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., and the images there are quite sympathetic to the Indians. But in contrast to that, in stark contrast to that, about 5 weeks ago, your colleague, Marshall Aiken, took a group of us to Buenos Aires. And in the Museum of Fine Art there, there was, in the place of honor, I would have to say, there was a painting that was probably 6 feet tall by 8 or 10 feet long, gorgeous colors, great drama. A band of Indians is riding out of a village that is burning. One of the Indians has a white woman who is naked across his saddle. The Indian next to him has a fine briefcase, just carrying it, which you assume was her companion's briefcase until her companion was killed. And the Indians are depicted as the most evil, depraved people you could possibly imagine. And we asked, well, what is this? And we were told this is representative of a genre of Argentine art. It's very popular. And we said, well, what is it? And he said, well, the Argentines exterminated their Indians. And then as soon as that was just about completed, these pictures began to appear in justification so the people wouldn't feel so bad at what they had done. Have you come across pictures of that extreme negative type here?
Well, there's one. Yep. There's one in this exhibit, which is one of the most familiar images of Indian capturing a woman and killing her. In this case, there was a famous statue that was placed in front of the U.S. Capitol in the 1850s. It would be generally referred to as the rescue group, which again kind of depicted an Indian tomahawking or about to. The tomahawk, a woman, with, of course, the pioneer rescuing her, which is why it's called the rescue group. Those images were very common in paintings, sculpture, and in other media. They tell us more about, as you pointed out, the national culture and the national ideology of conquest. The captivity narrative dates way back in colonial history, where all of the terror and horror that one can imagine experiencing when captured by a savage is depicted. And this ran right through 19th century novels as well as 20th century literature. And there's more of that, actually, than the kind of images that I shared with you toward the end of my talk. And they really don't speak to each other at all. But here in the United States, it was only after World War II where some of those images that appeared quite prominently in American public places were removed. I mean, the rescue group no longer stands outside the U.S. Capitol. Paintings that resemble it and depict similar themes have also been removed. When Ben Nighthorse Campbell was senator from Colorado. He is Native American. He's Cheyenne. He was instrumental in having some of those images removed, which, of course, is very problematic, to lovers of art and citizens in general. So, yes, we have many images like that in American art and literature.
Yeah, Professor?
That's interesting.
No, I thank you for pressing me on that point, because I did not mean to imply that there are images that are unbiased. It's a matter of explaining the bias of every image is biased. It has a point of view. It has kind of the limitations as well as the expectations, you know, of the viewer. And that's the thrill of doing, you know, what we do, is to kind of explore and explain how a person reached that point of view, and then decided to capture. But yeah, I mean, there's no distinction. I'm making no distinction between biased and unbiased images. It's just important for viewers to know, when they see any of these images, something about the context and the time in which they were produced. Does that help?
We've got time for two more questions. The gentleman there and a lady in the front.
Mine was just a quick follow-up.
So okay, well then, you go first.
Okay.
Well,
judge the bias.
Mm-hmm. It's a matter of, you know, one's degree of interest in the image, but certainly, I mean, the image begins the inquiry. It first creates a sense of wonder, and you can stop right there and appreciate it.
Right.
You can perhaps speculate about it or you know, see it clearly. It could be transparent in many cases. I'm not saying it's essential to learn more about the author or the artist in order to better appreciate the work, but really to better understand. My purpose is to better understand the world in which they produced. And I don't think it detracts, you know, from the significance, the aesthetic significance of the work, you know, to better understand it.
Okay, well, I think one last question from that gentleman in the back there.
My question was, what was not in the collection here, is there also perhaps a bias against mechanization? Because the mechanization that's happening to America during this period and the excitement of it and the changes it's bringing about are not included in this particular collection, as I remember.
Right. That's a good point. And I had planned to kind of use that as an analogy with the way American Indians are removed from the landscape. As you're pointing out, what's also removed are the technological means by which the artists, the travelers, reach these destinations. You know, steamboat travel begins very early in the 19th century. It's getting people up and down the Hudson River. The Industrial Revolution is underway. The Erie Canal is a representation and very much a part of that. And then railroads are also, you know, crisscrossing the landscape of New York. And that's all being used by these artists. And yet, as you say, it's not part of the story that they want to tell, at least not at that point in time. Now, in the Trans-Mississippi West, especially in the second half of the 19th century, depicting railroads, depicting cities on the landscape does become more common. And that's reflecting maybe a compatibility or a sense of compatibility between the machine and the natural world, which was very much a part of the ideology at the end of the century.
I think we're going to have to wrap it up and thank our speaker as well as the Frist for having put on this whole series of bringing a bit of added value to their exhibitions, and in particular thank Julie for helping make it happen, and Mark too for his role in this. Thank you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Wood and Professor Usner, for sharing with us your interests and scholarships. I would just like to say before you leave that on your way out of the auditorium, we have these wonderful flyers that say of special note that have a listing of all the wonderful programming that we have available this week for you, and most of it is free for your enjoyment. I just wanted to note a couple. On Thursday night, we have the Frist Center Holiday Concert. The Nashville Mandolin Ensemble will be here from 5:30 to 7:30 here in the auditorium. And then on Friday, we have, as always, music in the Grand Lobby. We have Robert Thompson Johnson and the Latin Jazz Group from 5:30 to 8:30. And also that night, our famous Friday night Artini, which is an informal discussion, and we'll have Associate Curator Nancy Kaysen and also Assistant Preparator Hans Schmidt-Motzen, who will be here to lead, like I said, an informal discussion about the work in the Cap Gallery by Deborah Ashheim. So feel free to come and join us for a drink and a wonderful discussion that evening. Thank you so much.